From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet novelist and screenwriter Tom Egwene. He wrote 92 in the Shade, The Missouri Breaks, and Keep the Change. Composer Danny Elfman just won a Grammy for the Batman theme. Elfman also wrote the scores for Beetlejuice and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Coming up, we talk with Danny Elfman about movie music. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by German jazz organist Barbara Dennerlein. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews an episode of Rescue 911 that features on-the-scene footage from the now-famous Stewart murder case in Boston. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Nicaragua's Sandinista Revolution withstood the bullets of U.S.-backed contra-rebels for more than a decade, but it was stopped yesterday by voters who opted instead for a U.S.-supported newspaper publisher. This morning, President Daniel Ortega conceded defeat to opposition candidate Violeta Chamorro. The election results pleased many in Congress, including Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole.
The people of Nicaragua have thrown the rascals out. And I hope the rascals will accept the verdict. It appears that Daniel Ortega used the same pollster I did in New Hampshire.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter observed yesterday's elections, one of more than 2,500 people to do so. Today he had some advice for the Bush administration.
I had a chance to talk to Secretary of State James Baker in Washington to give him a report on what was happening and encourage the United States to be constructive and not destructive, to be supportive. Let the Nicaraguan people know that our influence in the future will be toward peace, reconciliation, and economic progress.
Congress's attention will now turn toward just what aid, if any, will be sent to the Central American nation. The new administration is scheduled to take control of Nicaragua in April. Colombian drug traffickers have once again offered to give up the cocaine business and turn themselves in if they can be tried in Colombian courts. In a letter published in the local press, the extraditables asked the government to set up a mechanism for their surrender. Leslie Werpsa reports.
Drug traffickers using the name the extraditables have said they will turn themselves in as long as they can be tried in Colombia. The traffickers, probably from the Medellin group, also promised to give up their laboratories, airstrips, weapons, and explosives under the supervision of international observers. Their proposal was addressed to four former presidents and a bishop who were asked to serve as intermediaries with President Virgilio Barco. It is a continuation of a pledge made a month ago in which the traffickers accepted the victory of the government in the war against them and their illicit business. In the past few weeks, the extraditables have surrendered hostages, a ton of dynamite, and three gigantic cocaine processing complexes. Their attacks against the government and political and business leaders have also let up recently. There has been no official response yet to the new proposal. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Wipsa in Bogota.
Business executives told Congress today that President Bush's proposed increase of $500 million in spending for the Head Start program is a good first step, but the administration should fully fund the preschool program. The administration is calling for $1.9 billion for Head Start for the next fiscal year. That's a $500 million more than was appropriated last year. Baseball's labor negotiations broke off today in New York with no movement on the key issue of arbitration. Union chief Don Fehr is heading to Phoenix to brief player representatives. His absence means there will be an indefinite recess in the talks. The spring training shutout imposed by owners is now in its 12th day. Prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed more than 38 points, closing at 2602.48. This is NPR. More than 20,000 people chanting democracy and liberty gathered in the capital of Bulgaria today in a rally against the ruling Communist Party. The peaceful demonstration was the second in as many days. At least 150,000 people gathered in Sofia yesterday, chanting down with the Communist Party. It was the largest rally since the toppling of hardline leader Tudor Zhivkov in November. Both rallies were staged despite decisions of the party's Supreme Council on Friday to ban communist cells from the workplace, postpone general elections from May till June, and call for an observers to monitor the voting. The Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia signed an agreement today that completes Soviet troop withdrawal by the middle of next year. There are more than 80,000 troops in Czechoslovakia. Some of the soldiers went home today. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Prague.
On the same day as the foreign ministers of Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union signed an agreement in Moscow, the first trains heading east pulled out of Czechoslovak stations filled with Soviet troops. Flatbed cars carried tanks and trucks. According to the agreement, the majority of Soviet troops will be out by May 31st. The rest of the troops will pull out in two phases, ending in July 1991. The Soviet media made much of Havel's visit to Moscow today. He was given a warm welcome, and Havel said he thought the visit and agreement would strengthen bilateral ties. The Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, said it was the beginning of a new and dynamic relationship. In Prague, this is Deborah Amos.
Nelson Mandela travels to Lusaka, Zambia tomorrow for his first meeting in 27 years with leaders of the African National Congress. Today, Mandela met with the chairman of South Africa's largest corporation. Jesse Jackson ended months of speculation today by ruling out a race for the mayor of Washington, D.C. Jackson, however, left open the possibility that he may once again try for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1992. Jackson gathered more than 3 million votes in Democratic primaries and caucuses in 84 and some 7 million votes in 1988. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Thomas McGuane once described his writing style as a crackpot cross between traditional male literature and the Sid Caesar show. He writes about loners, outlaws, and outdoorsmen. McGuane wrote the screenplays for Missouri Breaks, Rancho Deluxe, Cold Feet, and 92 in the Shade, which he also directed. His novels include The Sporting Club, The Bushwhacked Piano, and Panama. His latest novel, Keep the Change, is partially set in Montana, where McGuane has lived since the late 60s. He lives on a 3,000-acre ranch, where he raises cattle and cutting horses. McGuane rides in the rodeo and has been Montana's cutting horse champion four times. Since several of his screenplays are offbeat westerns, I asked Tom McGuane if moving to Montana fulfilled a cowboy fantasy.
I really kind of got a cowboy fantasy by living there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to go there to be a cowboy. I was just a fisherman. And, ranch life. Ranching is the biggest business in Montana. It's a kind of a daily texture of Montana life. I love horses. I pretty much always loved horses, but I've passionately loved them as an adult. And then I've ranched. So that's all kind of part of the same reality. The kind of cowboy lifestyle is something that still doesn't appeal to me very much, but I do like ranching, and I do spend a lot of my life horseback.
I figure you must like westerns, because you've rode a few yourself.
I do like them pretty well. They have to be kind of off-center. I mean, my favorite westerns are things like Bad Company and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and kind of atypical westerns. The straight-up western seems kind of silly to me, and really kind of always has.
Why?
The moral simplistics of traditional westerns just kind of doesn't wash for me.
Mm-hmm. What about the atmosphere, and the charisma?
Well, the thing, you know, I love American landscapes of all kinds, and western movies are the only American movies in which American landscapes have much place. I think if there had been a great movement of New England filmmaking with a splendid New England coast and countryside in it, I'd have liked that kind of filmmaking, or California filmmaking, or Alaska filmmaking, where you could really see the earth in the films. But they've either been human, you know, they've been absolutely human sort of closet dramas, or westerns kind of traditionally. So it just happened that was western movies, the only place really where the American land is celebrated in American cinema.
One of the westerns that you wrote is Missouri Breaks,
right?
Which starred Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson. Now, when you heard that they were going to be cast, did you think that was good news?
No, I didn't. I wrote it really hoping to direct the film myself, and I was going to do it with my friends Harry Dean Stanton and Warren Oates, and we were going to make it inexpensively. Nicholson and Brando were cast. I mean, it was good news in some degree because you've written something. It looks like it's going to be done in a very auspicious way, and naturally that's rather flattering to any writer. At the same time, it became a different kind of project. I had seen it as a kind of a piece in which all the characters had sort of equal weight, and it was going to be the loss of a class of frontier people was going to really be what the story was about. With the casting and with the cost of acquiring those two actors for 6 weeks, the story suddenly had to be about Jack and Marlon. And the scenes had to kind of reflect that. So there was an immediate demand for more Brando Nicholson scenes. And that kind of was, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it was rather cross purposes with what I had set out to do. Not that I'm unhappy with what happened to it. There are lots of things that really pleased me tremendously about that movie. But the production values had to go up with the cost of the actors. Everything goes up, and kind of as a function of scale, and so it had a physical tone in some places that reminded me more of Paint Your Wagon than the kind of kind of mean looking thing that I had imagined.
So did you have to go back and do a lot of rewriting?
Not very much, but the fact that I didn't want to, and in fact finally refused to, meant that they had to find other ways of getting this revision work done. They ended up having Robert Towne come in and rewrite part of the ending, which made me unhappy. But at the same time, I think looking for pride of authorship in screenwriting is a really feckless waste of time.
Brando and Nicholson are two actors who have very distinctive ways of speaking, no matter what character they're playing. Their voices are very Brando and Nicholson.
Right.
When you knew that you were writing scenes for them, did you write any differently hearing their voice in your mind?
No, because it was all written by the time they were there.
How did you feel your dialogue worked in their mouths?
In some cases it did. Brando took such a kind of perverse approach to things, and also in a kind of an inventive approach to things, that it sometimes was quite rewarding. But I do know that when I found out he was doing it in an Irish accent, I remember being just absolutely astonished, because it was completely inappropriate to the part as written. And it remains an absolute enigma in the movie. Why is Marlon Brando speaking in an Irish accent? There's absolutely no reason for it.
How much did the Missouri Breaks experience sour you on movies?
Well, it soured me fairly considerably, because I think my Rancho Deluxe experience had made me really think that the screenwriter was the author. And after the Missouri Breaks, I would never make that mistake again. I think when movies get fairly expensive, writers get a little bit expendable. They can't really make movies without scripts. In fact, they can hardly finance movies without scripts. It's probably the most essential thing there is in movie making, but writers have allowed the situation to develop so that the writers have little power over the overall production of a movie, especially as compared to directors and actors.
I want to ask you about another screenplay that you wrote in the 70s but was just produced recently into a film, and I'm thinking of Cold Feet. And it starred Keith Carradine, Tom Waits, and Sally Kirkland. There's one line in there I really have to ask you about. Keith Carradine plays a pretty surly jewel thief, and Sally Kirkland plays someone who is in love with him, though he's kind of cool to her. But she comes onto him one morning. He's wanted he's wanted by the police, and he knows that they're after him. She climbs into his bed, and he looks at her, and he says, "Oh, you're not going to make me have sex, are you?" I thought that was a really funny line, in part because people are making love in such unlikely places at such inopportune times in all movies, you know?
Right.
Like they're wanted by the police, or war's breaking out, or, you know, some apocalypse is right around the corner and the two main characters stop and have sex.
Right. You know? I know. It's a window of opportunity.
Is that line yours? I know the screenplay was co-written. That's why.
Yes, that was.
And what were you thinking about when you wrote it?
Norman Mailer once wrote in The Prisoner of Sex that men have an incredible fragility when it comes to sex that has been insufficiently accounted for in literature. And it occurred to me that there was something just that had a sort of comic value to me about some gangster who was utterly threatened by the prospects of having to have sex. Also the aggression of Sally Kirkland's character struck me as just absolutely hilarious. It was a kind of a role reversal that wasn't done in a kind of schematic way. And I sort of imagined that the Carradine character was sort of in the position women frequently are in, you know, having somebody just sort of make this elephantine assault without much reference to their desires at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
All those things. I mean, sex is a great thing for producing comedy anyway. It's such an outlandish thing for anyone to be doing. I say facetiously, I hope it's clear. But it defies complete explanation, but I just thought that's one of my favorite funny moments in the film. It's not a film I'm real crazy about, but that I thought that was rather funny.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, both your novels and your screenplays, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Tom McGuane, and his new novel is called Keep the Change. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tom McGuane is my guest. His new novel is called Keep the Change. His other novels include Panama, Nobody's Angel, The Bushwhack Piano, and The Sporting Club. One of the things that you're famous for in your personal life is a period in the 70s that, in which there was a lot of wretched excess, sex, drugs, alcohol, fast cars. Was that still a productive period for you? Were you able to work during that?
Well, the thing that about that, I mean, I certainly did all those things to some degree. Not in a degree that would have seemed so remarkable to someone who was not living quite in the public eye to the degree that I was. I think most people I knew did as many of those things as I did. But they acquire this kind of monumentality because they kind of appear, they get into the press, and then they get enlarged, and then the press begins sort of remarking on the things they themselves created. So to be absolutely candid, it was never quite as big a deal as it's gone down historically as having been. I was very productive in those years.
Mm-hmm.
And like any other year in my adult life, I spent most of it sitting at the typewriter.
A lot of people who do go through a period of excess also have a period of bottoming out, and that's what gets them out of the excessive stuff. Did that happen to you?
Well, a little bit. I mean, John Keats said, how do you know what's enough until you find out what's too much? And my dreams have remained more or less intact. My dreams as an artist, and I've been trying to be a better artist since I was a little kid. And some of the things I tried didn't work, and some of them did. And probably one of them was to sort of hurl myself into that period. I don't have any regrets. In fact, I have some remarkably happy memories from the years that are supposed to have been so completely out of control.
But so how did you find out what's too much?
Well, I think that probably becoming depressed. I mean, I think there's something about the way I was living was sort of depressing me. And when you're depressed, you're sort of dysfunctional in every way. You just can't. I can't work when I'm depressed. And for some reason, something about the way I was living was depressing me, and I wanted to change it. Just exactly as others change their lives in or out of the arts.
Mm-hmm. Weren't you in a car crash also?
Yes, I was in a car crash. It's kind of a UFO event. I mean, I had a fast car, and I was driving through Texas at a very high rate of speed in rural Texas, and I pulled out to pass a truck, and during the night, a kind of black frost had settled on the road. It was just a light, invisible coating of ice, and so when I pulled out, the car just went backwards, and I cracked it up, and it was such a spectacular crash. It was at 140 miles an hour or something, and it happened in apparent slow motion. The car began shedding its parts, the windshield and fenders and things like that, that just seemed that one was watching one's life come to an end. It just seemed inevitable. It didn't seem possible to go through that kind of metallic explosion and still be standing there. So when it was over, it was kind of like having died and come to life again. And it would have been remarkable to anybody. I don't think I made more of it than it was, but I just really stopped and I thought, gosh, what a miracle. I'm now going to have another life, one I really kind of don't deserve. So it was a kind of starting over point in some way that I would find hard to articulate exactly. It's just that it was a real point to stop and think.
Do you know what you did differently the second time around?
Well, I'm still in the second time around.
Right, yes, right.
So, I really don't know. I mean, I suppose I live with the same, as much confusion as anyone, trying to live better and to be a better parent and a better husband, a better writer, to be more compassionate, to not be beguiled by material things, and yet to have all those same weaknesses and to want a new car and to eat better and to be selfish and not be interfered with. And so it's just the usual sort of skein of complications that one tries to tease one's way through with positive results. And it's just kind of like hacking your way through the jungle, really.
You know, I'm just curious, you used the word slow motion when you were describing what the crash felt like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a movie kind of word. So as a filmmaker, I'm wondering if it really seemed like slow motion when it was happening.
Yes, it did seem like slow motion in that you're so tremendously adrenalized with the idea that you are maybe at the end of your life, that you accumulate impressions at such a high rate of speed. It's literally like overcranking a camera, which is what produces slow motion photography. So the whole wreck, maybe it took 3 seconds, but if there were 6,000 impressions in it that you could recall,
mm-hmm.
like the hood lifting off and going over the top of the car, or a fender just sort of being peeled away by a fence post that was going 140. You get so many impressions that you really do, because to review it or to think back through it, it's really as though time were being suspended while you go through this process.
Your new novel has a father-son theme to it. The father dies and the son inherits the ranch and needs to decide if he wants to try to save it or not. I guess what I'm getting to is I think you were supposed to inherit your father's business, the auto supply business, and didn't really want it.
Well, it's not only that. It's interesting. I've been talking to interviewers and book critics and things like that, some of whom have been men, and this subject comes up. And I've just categorically stated that all sons are sort of spending a lot of the time of their lives trying to figure out what it is their father's required of them. Maybe all daughters feel that way about their mothers. I mean, do you wonder what your mother's wishing you're doing at this moment or what she thinks of your career or your...
Oh, of course I wonder about that.
Yeah, and I think that it's just one of those things that's just so there that people have kind of forgotten to define it. But most men go through their lives saying, gee, what is it that my father wanted me to do? My father was a kind of non-communicator I've sort of been guessing all my life. But I used to think I thought that was my private issue. But it turns out every man I've asked, I've been asking a lot of them this year, they say, yep, I sure wish I knew.
But of course, there's something even more tangible when there's a business to either be inherited or sold.
Well, I never considered going into that business. I wanted to be a writer when I was 10 years old. And my father's business came to my brother and I when I was in my 40s. I'd been out of the nest for 25 years and been self-sufficient all that time. So it was really never a daily living factor in my life. And I never thought for a minute when I was a young kid that I was going to go into my father's business.
Mm-hmm. Tom McGuane is my guest. He has a new novel called Keep the Change. Well, you live in Montana now on a ranch. And
right.
I'm wondering if it's good for you to have a balance of physical things to do, like your ranch work. You own cattle, and you're a cutter horse champion. Anyways, to balance physical work and writing, because a lot of writers don't get to do that. They just sit all day, all season, season.
You know, I don't know how they do that, actually. I couldn't do that. I guess I lack sufficient intellectual power to just do that round the clock. I just would lose my mind. I don't require that it would be ranching, but it would have to be something else. Interestingly enough, it could be business, or it could, but it would have to be something from which the writing could come, some access to information that was not purely literary. I think that would be all right for a few years. When I was in graduate school, I was quite happy to be completely bookish person, and I loved spending day after day in the library. But after a while, I mean, when you, I've been doing this for a long time now. I'm going to be 50 on my next birthday, and I've been a working writer all my adult life. What would you write about? I just think it's important to have some other thing that you do. I think it'd be great to be a doctor. It'd be great to be a cab driver or a bus driver or an airline pilot or some kind of interface with the physical operating world that's out there. I'm talking about fiction writers, not poets or essayists or literary critics. But we fiction writers need to be involved. That's why people like John Cheever joined the volunteer fire department, and other writers become fanatical golfers or anything. They just need to be in the world that's not simply the literary world.
I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier. You said that there were actually only a few Westerns that you really liked a lot. Yet you've written several Westerns yourself, and I wonder why you chose that form for some of your movies.
Hollywood kind of operates by stereotypes, and frankly, in some cases, Westerns are what were offered to me.
I see.
But also, I'm interested in the history of where I live. I've now lived in Montana more than any place I've ever lived, including where I grew up. And I'm interested in the history of the place and the romance of the place. Westerns are also the closest thing that we have to a formalized theater in a way. It's like our no theater. You don't have to sort of reinvent the form every time out. I mean, somebody once said that the classicism isn't everything, but it is the one thing which puts people to work faster than any other. And I think when you decide to write a Western, there's a certain amount of donnés, you know, that allow you to say, well, this is it. I mean, if it's a Western, it's going to be in the West, and it's going to have cowboys and maybe Indians and good guys and bad guys. And I'm saying it is with as much banality as I can, but at least there's a kind of structure there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to play against that structure. They now, you know, are so completely kind of defunct that it doesn't seem to apply. When I first was writing Westerns, there were all these firms in Hollywood that supplied horses and costumes and stunt riders and all. And they had been there since, you know, the teens of the century, and it worked all through the television Western era and so on. They no longer exist now. They'd been there for 60 or 70 years, and they've all vanished. So, at least in terms of popular culture, the market share that the Western myth once held is really no longer there.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks for doing it.
I'm a listener.
Oh, great.
All right, Terry.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tom McGuane's latest novel is Keep the Change. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, German film director Volker Schlondorf. His films include The Tin Drum, Swan in Love, and The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum. His new film is an adaptation of Margaret Atwood's novel The Handmaid's Tale. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Music from Big Top Pee Wee, composed by Danny Elfman. Elfman also wrote the scores for Pee Wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, and Batman, for which he just won a Grammy. But he got his start in the rock group Oingo Boingo. Coming up, Elfman tells us how he taught himself to write for the movies. Last fall, when Charles Stewart of Boston called the police to report that he and his pregnant wife had been shot, the TV crew from Rescue 911 was there. This now famous footage is featured on the next episode of Rescue 911. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the album Straight Ahead by German jazz organist Barbara Dennerlein. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush today called the results of the election in Nicaragua a victory for democracy. The president, in comments to the nation's governors, also said that he had sent messages of congratulation to Violeta Chamorro for her victory and to President Daniel Ortega for his handling of the election and his promise to abide by the results. More on White House reaction from NPR's Jim Angle.
After years of undeclared war between the U.S. and Nicaragua, the Bush administration began this morning efforts to fashion a new policy. One official said the U.S. feels a moral responsibility to help rebuild the Nicaraguan economy after the Contra war and economic sanctions. Though officials say no decisions have yet been made, the first change is expected to be a lifting of those sanctions in place since 1985. And President Bush told a meeting of U.S. governors today that all the fighting should now end.
Given the clear mandate for peace and democracy, there is no reason at all for further military activity from any quarter. And we hope the ceasefire will be reestablished without delay and respected by all sides.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater suggested there will need to be one more round of aid for the Contras, this time to send them home. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
In a second day of renewed violence in the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip, scores of people were wounded. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem that Israeli troops opened fire on rioters following the funeral of a young man killed in Gaza this weekend.
The clash erupted in Rafiah, a small town on the border between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. The shooting apparently started when troops intruded into the tent of the family mourning their 20-year-old son shot dead in a clash Sunday. Palestinians attacked the soldiers, who began shooting. Other residents took to the streets, defying an army-imposed curfew. The army also used a helicopter to disperse rioters with tear gas. The army says 14 people were lightly wounded, but local sources put the figure much higher. According to the UN, over 40 people were treated in their clinic with gunshot wounds. Meanwhile, today on the Israeli-occupied West Bank, authorities began a phased reopening of 16 community colleges closed since the beginning of the Palestinian uprising 2 years ago. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Israeli Foreign Minister Ahrens is now in Poland on a four-day visit during which full diplomatic relations between the two countries will be restored. Diplomatic ties between these two nations were cut by Poland after the 1967 Middle Eastern War. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 38 points to close at 2,602.48 on volume of 149 million shares. Trading was moderate as advancing issues led declines. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. When Barbara Dennerlein was 12 years old, she got a small electric organ for Christmas. The young German girl took to the instrument immediately, and 2 weeks later, her parents traded it in for a bigger model. By the time she was 15, Dennerlein was working in jazz clubs in Munich. Now in her mid-20s, she's recorded 5 albums in Europe. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of her first record to be released in this country. On it, she's joined by 3 American musicians.
Barbara Dennerlein sounds a lot like a typical jazz organ player, but the quartet on her new album, Straight Ahead on the Angel label, doesn't sound like a typical organ group. I'll explain why that is, a step at a time. But first, here's what Barbara Dennerlein sounds like. Dennerline has obviously listened a lot to classic jazz organ players like Jimmy Smith. But there's one way she sounds different from the rest. Like most organ groups, Dennerline's doesn't have a bass player because the organist plays the bass parts on foot pedals. Organ bass usually sounds a little like a subway train heard from street level, a sort of low and indistinct rumble under the feet. Dennerline's bass runs are an exception. They have the flexibility and some of the plump sound of an upright string bass. She sounds more like a real bass player than any jazz organist I know. Dennerline's footwork isn't as spontaneous as a bass player's fingering. She repeats the same patterns as if she's memorized them, so she can concentrate on what her hands are doing. Dennerline's guitarist, Mitch Watkins, doesn't focus on the gritty blues licks organ group guitarists usually play. He sounds more modern, even when he's playing the blues. His tone, his slinky lines, and twisted harmonies obviously owe a lot to guitar hero John Scofield. The traditional horn in an organ group is tenor saxophone. In Dennerline's quartet, it's the trombone of Ray Anderson. Anderson is a master of rude sounds and outlandish effects. He's the wild card who really takes this music someplace else, especially when he's using his plumber's helper, a rubber plunger mute. The drummer there is Ronnie Barrage, who really locks into Dennerline's sense of rhythm. Put them all together, the organist's hands and feet, a space-age guitar and stone-age trombone, and a powerful drummer who really listens, and you get some pretty irresistible music. Here's the quartet on Ray Anderson's It Just So Happens. There's one other reason for this album's success. Producer Matthias Winkelmann put this quartet together and sent them out on the road for a few nights, so they had a chance to settle in before going into the studio. That's why this pickup group sounds like a real band. Barbara Dennerlein's quartet may have been assembled from disparate parts, but it doesn't sound it.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Danny Elfman is one of the top young composers in Hollywood. He wrote the scores for Batman, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Big Top Pee-wee, Beetlejuice, and Scrooged. He's scoring the upcoming film, Dick Tracy. Elfman has a parallel rock career as the leader of the band Oingo Boingo. Last week at the Grammys, Elfman won a Composer's Award for the Batman theme. This is an excerpt of an interview I recorded with him just before Batman came out. Here's the music he won the Grammy for. Before writing the theme, did you have to sit down with the director, Tim Burton, and decide, you know, what kind of tone the theme should have?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What did you talk about? What did you decide on?
We basically, when we sit down, and it's what you call spotting a movie, you talk about the entire movie as a whole, and you talk about different variations that you're going to want the theme to take. We needed something that was very simple, so it could state itself in very few notes and still become Batman's identity, and that could play both in a more gothic, romantic sense or in a more kind of an up-tempo march.
Yeah, when did you start becoming aware of good film music?
When I was about 12, 13, and I was growing up on all those wonderful science fictions in the 60s, many of them which had Bernard Herrmann scores, although I didn't know it, who it was really until later, I knew that it had a big effect on me. Journey to the Center of the Earth, Jason and the Argonauts, The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is still one of my favorite scores. That's where I really started becoming aware of film music. And then as a teenager, I got heavily into other composers, and especially Fellini films with Nina Rota's music.
Has writing film music given you the opportunity to express certain musical interests of yours that wouldn't be of interest at all to a rock audience? I'm thinking a lot of people have
I don't think it would be of any interest to a rock audience.
Yeah, well, I think some people even have musical tastes that they'd be almost embarrassed to admit to a rock audience because it would be considered square or something.
Well, everything I write for orchestra is square by rock and roll standards. I don't give a damn what anybody thinks. I love the challenge, and I love working in film, and I also love doing rock and playing with the band. So what a rock and roll audience may or may not think of my work for film, I really could care less if it works for the film. And vice versa, I don't care what people who are into my music or into film music in general think of what I do when I'm with Oingo Boingo.
Do you hear any connection at all between your rock work with Oingo Boingo and your film scores?
No. Mm-hmm. No. In fact, I think that's probably why I've gotten successful as a film composer coming from rock and roll. I think that's the mistake most rock and rollers make when they get a chance to score films, is they don't leave what they've done behind them and approach it completely fresh as a completely new medium. And I fortunately elected on my first film there to let it all go and go back to my early roots as a child before I even ever heard rock and roll.
Which was what?
When I used to listen to films, the types mm-hmm. of films that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was, if there's anything in retrospect that I did right, it was approaching my first film orchestrally with no rock and roll attitude towards it at all.
Danny Elfman is my guest. This is music that he wrote for the film Pee-wee's Big Adventure. The first film that you scored was also the first film you worked on with Tim Burton, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I think you'd worked on a small film before that, but really you had like no orchestral experience, either composing or arranging. How did you get the job?
I haven't a clue. You'd have to ask Tim. He took an enormous gamble, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm lucky that he did.
Now, I read about you that you didn't read music, at least when you were in your teens and starting in rock bands, you didn't read music. Did you read music by the time you worked on Pee-wee? Yeah.
No, I didn't. Doing rock and roll for a decade, or a little over a decade, there really never is any reason to read music. There is so very little written music in that musical form.
So how did you write a score for a major motion picture without reading music?
I taught myself to write, basically, and you don't have to read to be able to write. I rely on memory and retaining pieces of music, even if it's a long piece of music, very clearly in my mind until I have the last note of it down on paper. So I get pretty obsessive and intense, especially if I'm working on a 7 or 8 minute cue, because it means keeping a lot of music going in my head at the same time.
Your film for Beetlejuice, especially like in the opening, it really mixes horror and comedy really well.
Well, that's what we were going for.
Right, exactly. And you use terrific orchestrations in it. It's like in the opening, there's a French horn, strings, and tambourine. The tambourine really works in there.
Oh, good. We were afraid that it got out of control.
But, did you really? Oh.
I'm glad you think so.
Did you seriously think it got out of control?
At the time, percussion sometimes in a very live room is hard to control, and whatever level you get it on tape, you can never make it softer again. That's where it's very unlike rock and roll, where you have complete control over everything. In an orchestral piece, you can't change things very much from how they're laid down on tape. You can pull out a woodwind line a little here and there, or a French horn line if you're looking for it, but most of the sound is in the room and is in all the mics, so you have to get it pretty close to the way you want it.
Thank you. I have all these records of, like, the great film composers conducting their own scores. Could you ever conduct? Do you
conduct? No, I have no desire to conduct at all. First of all, I don't think I'd make a good conductor. But more importantly, film music is played in the theaters through speakers. And even though the music in the room where the orchestra is playing sounds much more lush and wonderful, especially the strings, it's not the way it's going to sound later. And I want to sit in the booth and hear how it sounds through the speakers, because the balances really do change. And you'll hear things through the speakers that you won't hear sitting in the room. And also, I want to sit very closely with the director. And most importantly, I want to see exactly how my music is playing against screen, because I'm really a stickler for timings. And I like to see that it's falling exactly where I intended it to.
What new challenges did writing the score for the Batman movie have for you?
Well, it was my first action adventure, epic type of a score, so it was real difficult in that sense. And it was also a lot of music, 75 minutes of score. Beetlejuice only had maybe 48 minutes, which is about average for a film. And also I was dealing with it in a much more simple way than I would most movies. I tried to take an approach that was almost more going towards Max Steiner's type of approach to movies in the 40s, of dealing with many variations on a single simple theme.
Musician and composer Danny Elfman. Here's more of his music from Batman. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, tell us about your coverage of the Nicaraguan elections.
Well, we are going to do everything we can to find out what happened. We have a number of reports from Nicaragua, and then we have experts here in Washington and around the country who we'll be talking to about such things as why we didn't know that that Violeta Chamorro was going to win, and we thought the Sandinistas were, and what the United States policy in future should be toward Nicaragua, and how United States policy in the past affected what happened on Sunday in that country. So we're going to be spending quite a lot of time looking south, Terry.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tuesday night on CBS, the series Rescue 911 examines a crime that's been in the national news since the fall, the Stewart murder case in Boston. Last October 23rd, Boston police got a call from Charles Stewart from his car phone saying that he and his wife had been shot. Stewart claimed a black man was the assailant, but then just before committing suicide, Stewart became a prime suspect himself. The story ignited racial tensions in Boston. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of Rescue 911's replay of the crime.
Where are you right now, sir? Can you indicate to me?
No, I don't know. I don't know. He made us go to an abandoned area.
Okay, sir. Can you see out the windows? Can you tell me where you are, please?
No. I don't know. I don't see any signs. Oh, God.
Are you near Brigham and Women's Hospital?
No. We went straight through.
What kind of car do you have, sir?
Pardon me?
What kind of vehicle do you have?
Toyota Cressida.
Toyota Cressida?
It's a...
Are you in the city of Boston, though?
Yes.
Can you give me any indication where you might be? Any buildings?
No.
Okay, has your wife been shot as well?
Yes. In the head.
In the head?
You've probably already heard some of that distress call on the national news and seen footage of Charles and Carol Stewart slumped over in the front of their car just after the police arrived. What you may not know is that that footage was provided by a TV crew for Rescue 911. That crew just happened to be riding around with some Boston paramedics responding to the call. As a result, this particular segment of Rescue 911 is a big deal, and much less reliant on recreations than usual. Still, in the first part of the program, police dispatchers recreate their roles, matching their voices and activities to the actual 911 call recorded at the time. It's a very convincing illusion. But, as host William Shatner points out, once the Stewarts are located, no further illusions are necessary.
The footage that follows is not a recreation. It was taped during a ride-along with the Boston Emergency Medical Service on the night Charles and Carol Stewart were shot, and on the days that followed.
What comes next are scenes of the Stewarts being rushed to different hospitals, Charles Stewart being prepped for surgery, and a lot of interviews with the police, paramedics, doctors, and others who located and tried to save the Stewarts. These interviews are conducted before and after Stewart is implicated in his wife's death, and their tones are quite different.
The gut and the grizzle and the savvy this man had, just the will to live, to keep on going, is incredible.
It was an unsettling call to take. And you just try to put it behind you. Unfortunately, with the media attention, the team really hasn't had a chance to put the mission behind us. And that's normally what you do, you have to do. Otherwise, you couldn't perform effectively. You couldn't emotionally perform effectively if you kept the image of that night and that mission always in the back of your mind.
The story's real heroes, of course, are the emergency workers who are seen acting, reacting, and even reenacting in this Rescue 911 segment. It's fascinating stuff, but I have to say I'm still bothered by this reenactment business, for a different reason than before. They used to be staged so badly on this show, they ruined the real-life drama of the actual 911 recordings. Now, in the opening segments of the Stewart story, the recreations are done so well that it's hard not to believe your eyes. Frankly, I'm not sure which is worse. When reality can be faked this convincingly, the only thing to do is to disbelieve everything. I wish they'd label everything clearly and constantly so I wouldn't have to worry about what is real and what is staged.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Vablitis. Roberta Shurock directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet German film director Volker Schlondorf. He made The Tin Drum, The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum, and the new film The Handmaid's Tale, starring Faye Dunaway and Robert Duvall. Also, the author of The Consumer Guide, Shopping for a Better World, talks about how to be a socially conscious shopper at the supermarket. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.